From WJFF
Radio, from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, long COVID, 5 years after the pandemic. People living with long COVID often feel dismissed, disbelieved, and unsupported by their healthcare providers. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports on how people living with long COVID continue to juggle chronic COVID symptoms and doubt from others. New Hope Community is advocating for Medicaid funding. The Sullivan County nonprofit supports people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We'll talk to New Hope's CEO about its commitment to advocating for the resources, attention, and policy protections necessary to continue providing their vital services. Empowering Voices and Bridging Gaps in Healthcare. We'll learn more about the third annual NEPA Medical Advocacy Conference and genetic testing scams, what seniors need to know. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Department of Health and Human Services is now the latest federal agency to announce big layoffs. The agency says it will dismiss 10,000 full-time employees. Officials say it's in line with President Trump's DOGE efforts. The agency says Medicare and Medicaid will remain intact. Stocks open lower this morning as President Trump opens a new front in his trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 20 points in early trading.
Auto stocks were mostly lower after President Trump ordered a 25% tax on all imported cars and car parts beginning next week. The tariff, which is 10 times the current import levy, is intended to boost domestic auto production. It's also expected to make it more expensive to buy a new vehicle, and other countries are likely to retaliate with higher tariffs of their own on U.S. exports. In an overnight social media post, Trump warned Europe and Canada could face even higher tariffs if they try to retaliate. Revised figures from the Commerce Department show the U.S. economy grew slightly faster at the end of last year than initially reported. GDP expanded at an annual rate of 2.4% in October, November, and December. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration is beginning to step away from voting rights lawsuits that were first brought during the Biden administration. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports voting rights advocates fear this could weaken legal protections against racial discrimination in elections.
The Justice Department dropped its lawsuit over Texas redistricting maps and its case against the Georgia County's election system, both that claimed the collective power of voters of color was being diluted in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Former DOJ official Gilda Daniels says she's concerned some Republican state officials are trying to block people from bringing these kinds of lawsuits.
If you actually make it harder to demonstrate that a Section 2 violation exists, and at an administration that is reluctant and or unwilling to bring Section 2 cases, it could lead to dormancy that I don't think we want to see as a democracy.
Georgia officials have asked the DOJ to drop its case against the state's election laws. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
Congressional Democrats want to know whether top Trump officials put national security at risk when they recently communicated war plans on a commercial messaging app. Some of the Trump officials testified before Senate and House Intelligence Committees this week. Colorado Democratic Congressman Jason Crow is one committee member. He says the Trump administration should stop downplaying this very serious issue.
What the Trump administration is saying is, you know what, the people at the top, they run by different rules. They're protected and the rules don't apply to them, which of course sends a message that, you know, culture is dysfunctional and sends a message down the chain of command that these things don't matter. So that's where things start deteriorating within organizations, and that's where people end up getting killed.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. You're listening to NPR from Washington. Vice President Vance is embarking on a trip to Greenland this week. The trip is fraught. That's because President Trump continues to emphasize that the United States will take over the world's largest island, a territory of Denmark. The trip was originally planned as a cultural visit led by the vice president's wife. She was supposed to see Greenland's national dog sled race, but that part of the visit was called off as Greenlanders voice anger over Trump's statements. Now, NPR's Joe Hernandez reports the Vances will visit the only U.S. military base on the island.
Bedufik Space Base is a Space Force installation on the northwestern coast of Greenland. Its location between the northern U.S. and Russia is critical to the U.S. military, says Troy Bouffard, a professor of Arctic security at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
The center sector there with that base is absolutely paramount.
The military conducts missile warning, missile defense, and space surveillance missions there. Construction on the base began in secret in 1951 in a joint effort between the U.S. and Denmark, which partially controls Greenland. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
The rest of Major League Baseball has its opening day today. 28 of the 30 teams will be in action. The league's official opening day actually started last week in Japan. That is where the Chicago Cubs and the Los Angeles Dodgers kicked off the regular 2025 season. The Dodgers took both games over the Cubs in what was called the Tokyo Series. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is a special edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Erin Shear with Eating Upstate, where I interview upstate restaurateurs and food professionals. On today's show, we'll look back at...
All right, sorry for that technical difficulty. You're listening to Radio Chatskill, and we're live. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. 5 years ago this month, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo declared a statewide lockdown to prevent the spread of the COVID pandemic. The long-term toll it's left on people's lives is immeasurable. More than 7 million people around the world died from COVID. More than 1.2 million of that number died in the U.S., while much of the world is reopened for many, life as usual has not resumed. People with long COVID continue to juggle chronic COVID symptoms and doubt from others. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports.
Extreme fatigue, brain fog, long-term gastrointestinal issues like trouble swallowing and constipation. These are just a handful of more than 200 symptoms of long COVID. Long COVID is a chronic illness that happens after someone has a COVID infection and experiences COVID symptoms for more than 3 months. About 7% of the population in the U.S. reported having long COVID, according to a 2024 medical study. That's roughly 17.8 million people who have had or currently have long COVID symptoms.
I mean, short answer, like, it sucks.
That's Jamie Sannon, founder of Celebrate 845. It's a mutual aid and arts organization that distributes masks and COVID tests throughout the Hudson Valley. In 2021, Celebrate 845 started developing COVID-conscious resources to help people create COVID-safe spaces, find free testing kits and masks, and help people find others who still care about COVID.
When COVID hit in 2020, I mean, so many of our folks were like some of the hardest hit because they were artists and their gigs got canceled, or like maybe like they're folks of color who are already having a rough time navigating the healthcare system. So it just made sense that we cared, and yeah, we just haven't stopped.
Yeah. Since then, they've distributed over 3,000 rapid tests across New York State and heard from dozens of people living with long COVID.
There's a lot of grief that comes with it. Maybe grief around, like, your body used to do certain things and now it can't, or it's harder. People like having, like, brain fog, so having to just sort of redesign their day-to-day and, like, their capacity to do a certain amount of stuff in a day, and sometimes it's unpredictable. And I think, like, yeah, we live in such like a productivity connected to worth type society. So there's a lot of grief that I know that people hold. And as far as the healthcare system goes, I mean, yikes. Like that is stuff that disabled folks have really been shouting from the rooftops for years and years.
Sannon says that getting Celebrate 845's efforts off the ground was challenging. But over time, she's been able to build partnerships with people across the state.
I feel like on the local level, it wasn't super received by maybe, you know, the people doing events. But people who cared about COVID still were like, oh, snap, yes. So it sort of helped us become this hub on the regional level, which was like really unexpected. Yeah, and just trying to like champion and like remind people that, yeah, working like accessibility stuff into your events has always been relevant, but like especially with something like COVID that continues to like rip through our communities, just trying to like keep reminding people as best we can.
Dr. David Petrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation for the Health System at Mount Sinai, said that long COVID can happen to anyone.
We don't seem to have any rhyme or reason to who is going to get sick and then fail to recover. So that's one of the more troubling aspects of long COVID, is that it's really hard for us to predict who's going to develop it.
Since the start of the pandemic, Dr. Petrino has been treating patients with long COVID at the Cohen Center for Recovery, a specialized clinic in New York City for long COVID treatment and other chronic illnesses. While he's been studying and treating the disease for years, he said that new information about COVID is constantly popping up, some that still leave him surprised.
Because of the ability of COVID to break down the central nervous system, every COVID infection you survive, whether you feel that you have long COVID or not, every infection you survive, you lose about 4 to 6 IQ points. And that one really got me.
Wow.
Like, okay, I'm masking everywhere and I'm just hiding away from people.
One of the biggest challenges Petrino says his patients face is getting others to believe they're even sick.
Often what we hear from our patients is that they're not believed. They're told that it's psychological. They're told that, you know, this is probably happening just because they're stressed out and it's, you know, not a real disease. And it's just extraordinarily hard to find someone who's willing to actually believe that they're sick, let alone provide them with skilled options for care. The first thing that they should hear is that this is something that is relatively common and many people are going through it, so it's real. And, you know, the next thing is to try to find specialized long COVID clinics in their area.
But Jamie Sannon of Celebrate 845 says that getting to COVID recovery programs isn't always easy.
If you're somebody who is trying to take precautions, it's like, are you taking the train? Like, that might not feel safe. Are you taking the bus? That might not feel safe. Do you have to drive? Like, there's just so many factors for even getting the care, like to physically getting to the care, if the care is even available.
Ellenville Regional Hospital in Ellenville, New York, is one of just a few long COVID programs in the Catskills region. Teresa Versano is the hospital's director of rehabilitation services. She says they created a dedicated COVID rehab program after noticing some patients kept coming back under the same or worsening conditions.
What we were seeing is patients that were in our subacute rehab were still having like post-exertional malaise, you know, or exercise tolerance and breathing issues even a year after. Mm-hmm. And then we were figuring out, okay, we saw them in swing. And now they're still having difficulties. And our patients ranged anywhere from like, you know, 26 years of age to 84. And some were never even, you know, and then we had some that were never even admitted into a hospital, were still suffering or couldn't get through work because of being, you know, COVID positive 3 months earlier.
Ellenville patients come in twice a week. They focus on a number of physical therapy exercises targeted at common symptoms of long COVID, like balance and strength training, and improving their respiratory system. Versano adds that validating patients' feelings can make a huge difference in their recovery.
Having that same therapist with them to, again, validate, to reassess, you know, and also validate to them, we are limited with our resources right now in the medical world. We can't give you why this is, but what we can do is try to work through it and show you what's been working evidence-based at this point.
And at this point, there's still a lot healthcare providers don't know. While significant progress has been made to understand the virus, there is no one cure for long COVID. Specific diagnosis for long COVID also doesn't exist.
Right now in our medical field, we do not have any specialized tests to actually be so granular to diagnose long COVID. I think our primary care physicians and nurse practitioners are inundated with patients, but they weren't feeling very validated because, of course, they would do a chest x-ray and say, no, you're good. You're just tired. You're good.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, there's nothing coming up on any kind of lab work or x-rays or pulmonary function tests, everything that you would think would be able to find long COVID or diagnosis isn't there yet.
Patients and healthcare providers also face challenges unique to being in the Catskills rural areas. A 2022 study published by the Journal of Rural Health suggests that the overall rate of COVID infection and subsequent mortality in rural communities is higher than in their urban counterparts. Unemployment gaps in rural communities can also be a financial barrier for people who may not have the income or employment for health insurance or to afford treatment for long COVID. Versano adds that rural hospitals often lack resources available to urban hospitals.
We just don't have those resources. I think one, we do know here, especially from our, even just simply our, this COVID protocols that we put through, having a mental health therapist would be so helpful with having access. I just think we don't have access or resources like bigger hospitals, especially down in the city and urban areas. I think right now, when you look at long COVID, the programs down in the city, they're doing a lot of lab work with it, as well as having a pulmonologist there to see pre and post exams to see how they're doing. We really don't have that data here. We don't even have a pulmonologist here in rural health to do that.
These resource gaps are happening while sweeping federal cuts hit the National Institute of Health and the Center for Disease Control, two federal agencies critical for providing COVID data and resources. Dr. Petrino and Mount Sinai said that access to reliable data on COVID has already disappeared under the current Trump administration.
The CDC Household Pulse Survey, which was an incredibly useful source of information for a number of things related to just United States health status, with the Trump administration, it was pulled. So not only are they no longer doing the CDC Household Pulse Survey, they've removed the Household Pulse data, which is unfortunate because it was such a useful way of us being able to track literally the pulse, the health of the nation over time, and the data's been pulled. So it's a real big loss of reliable data.
At the grassroots level, Jamie Sannon at Celebrate 845 is focused on mobilizing residents. They've been using zines, art, and online resources to remind people why masks are important in the first place and where to find them. To date, they've set up free PPE distribution hubs at more than 30 locations across New York.
Anyone can get COVID. You can be young, you can be old, you can be, air quotes, healthy and good health. So if you can get COVID, then you can get long COVID. And something that I just find myself saying so often is like, the tools work. And the tools being things like masks, the tools being things like air purification, opening a window, like trying to do more stuff outside. Like there's a lot of layers of mitigation. And I think that people are just so, they haven't like processed their grief from lockdown. So they just associate COVID with like isolation. And it's like, we can still gather, like we don't have to be isolated, but like there are a lot of tools that are just gonna help us stay safer. And it's actually going to make the spaces more accessible. And it's like, why wouldn't you want that?
In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And as you may have heard earlier on NPR News, the Trump administration today announced that 10,000 employees of the Health and Human Services Department would be dismissed as part of a major reorganization designed by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The layoffs are a drastic reduction in personnel for the health department, which now employs 82,000 people. As part of that restructuring, HHS is planning to close its Office for Long COVID Research and Practice, according to an internal email from the office's director, Ian Simon. We'll take a break, and when we come back, New Hope Community, dedicated to supporting individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We'll talk to their CEO after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, the unknown history of the iconic little black dress.
Something about dressing rich, mostly white women is uncomfortable, especially while you're wearing the little black dress, your work uniform. You begin to wonder, why do I look like I'm her maid?
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Trout season is kicking off in Trout Town, USA. On April 1st at 7 a.m., it's the first cast at the Junction Pool in Roscoe. And the sold-out 64th Annual Two-Headed Trout Dinner is April 5th at the Rockland House, featuring a raffle and silent auction. There's still time for local businesses to donate items to the raffle and silent auction. More information about all of the events during trout season in Trout Town, USA at roscoeny.com. Paid for by the Roscoe-Rockland Chamber of Commerce. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New Hope Community, the nonprofit in Sullivan County dedicated to supporting individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, is committed to advocating for the resources, attention, and policy protections necessary to continue providing their vital services. And joining us now with more and news of some employment opportunities as well at New Hope is Debbie McGinnis, CEO of New Hope Community. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. I kind of made a little, synopsis of what you guys do. Tell us a little bit more about your mission, though.
Oh, my gosh. Our mission is incredibly important. We really work to empower people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to have unbelievable choice, to really have a life that has the most meaning for them.
And I mentioned that you are committed to advocating for those folks that provide these, that rely on the services that you provide. Previously, I just announced that the Trump administration has decided they're going to reduce the workforce at HHS, which impacts, multiple things. Earlier this month, you joined other healthcare providing agencies in New York State at the Rally for the Valley to advocate for Medicaid and keeping that. Talk a little bit about how important it is to have this funding for the people you serve.
Well, it's critically important because basically all of our funding is from Medicaid. And this is something that really fuels people's lives and ensures their safety, their health and wellness. It really obviously fuels our workforce. I mean, we have to have robust funding for people that are very vulnerable, that tend to have some very complex needs and obviously have the right to live their best life just like the rest of us.
And the administration is saying that Medicare and Medicaid won't be impacted, but we know that sometimes this funding can be affected by other things that are happening around it. You're advocating for stable funding. Why is that important and critical to have stable funding rather than the inconsistency that may occur?
Well, it's funny because in the past couple of decades, in all honesty, we have not really received the support we needed on a state and federal level specific to funding reimbursement levels. And we've really fallen behind in terms of not being able to compete with the market. And when we end up not having the necessary funding, it also impacts what we're able to pay our staff. And of course, having a workforce that is in place and able to meet the needs of the people you support on a 24/7 basis is critical. So when we went to the rally in the valley, getting back to that for a moment, we are asking for a 7.8% targeted inflationary increase to be included in this year's executive budget. Currently, both the House and the Senate have recommended that happen.
In New York.
In New York.
Just to be clear, yeah.
Yes, thank you. And absolutely, it's Hochul's executive budget. And she put in 2.1%. We're really hoping with the recommendations that have been put forth that we will get that, because that is critical to us continuing to enhance the wages that we are able to offer our staff so that we can have the staff we need to do extremely important work.
The rally in the valley was earlier this month. It was the second one, I understand, in Pomona, New York, organized in part by, is it Jawanio?
Jawanio.
Mm-hmm. And they support people with mental and developmental disabilities.
Correct.
Their CEO at the time said, here we are, quote, here we are being that squeaky wheel. Mm-hmm. And that's important because, as you said, you've been underfunded. What are you asking more for New York State to do? This budget deadline is, of course, coming up April 1st.
Yes. So Randy, the CEO of Jawanio, absolutely. Very fair point. Out of sheer necessity, we have to be the squeaky wheel. And if we don't speak up and advocate, then we're, shame on us, because this is important and we have to make it happen. So in addition to the 7.8%, We're also looking to have a wage commission created because I think, as most people know, DSPs do not have a standard occupational classification for their job, and therefore data is not gathered on them as required by DOL SOCs that are currently in existence. So we need to have a wage commission that can really take a look at the profession, understand, you know, how healthy is it? What are the wages that are being paid across the state? What is the future of the profession? It really helps build and feed a stable and growing profession. So that's one thing. And we're also looking for a couple of other things that are sort of cleaning up our house a bit. In 15, rate setting went from OPWDD, which is Office for People with Developmental Disabilities, over to DOH, Department of Health. And we really need that rate setting to go back to OPWDD. It's a more efficient process and will really help us get our funds on a state basis in a timely manner. So a couple of things like that. We're mm-hmm. out advocating very actively with action alerts, going to rallies, sending out letters, meeting personally with our legislators. And this is our responsibility. We have to do it.
It is your responsibility, and I understand that. But I'm just wondering, like, when you talk to someone to say an organization that supports people with developmental disabilities, you would think, that sounds good. They should be okay. But why do you have to be the squeaky wheel? Why is there not enough funding there? What is that that is preventing that, to me, logical funding pipeline to occur?
I think, unfortunately, historically, we've always been a population that tends to be a little bit more forgotten compared to other populations and what other needs may be. And it's really unfortunate to say that. We've certainly made a lot of progress since Willowbrook in the 70s, but there's still so much more to do. And it seems often that unless someone has a personal connection where it is meaningful in their own life, that they know someone that has an intellectual developmental disability, that there's a learning curve where you need to educate, you need to grab their hearts, you really need to speak to the fact that, you know what, incredibly special humans, this is our collective human experience, and there's just a responsibility there that we all have to take up and we have to forward.
You mentioned having a stable workforce. You are looking for more people to join your workforce. What are those opportunities for folks?
Well, we have a lot of opportunities for what's known as direct support professionals, and we also have nursing opportunities. And I would have to say, I've been with New Hope Community for about 6.5 years. I've been in this field for several decades, and it's an incredibly special, meaningful field to be in. And I think that when people come to us and they really understand the mission and they see how much it matters and they see the impact that we can have in forwarding best lives with people, it's just a beautiful opportunity. And a lot of people, I think, end up being with us for decades. In fact, I think we have somebody right now that's been with us for over 30 years. And it's just, it's meaningful stuff. So we've just enhanced our wages that we're offering. We have a lot of training opportunities. We understand that people would like to have career opportunities in terms of growth. We have this wonderful eBadge Academy for credentialing. We're working with SUNY with their DSP micro-credentialing program that we have a lot of staff enrolled in. We are forward-thinking. We listen. We give the why on things. What they think about, what they need matters. And I think that we're a very responsive employer. Our nurses love the fact they can have long-term relationships with the people that they support. They're not doing on-call work. And often, I used to work as a pediatric nurse many, many years ago in a hospital, and you do shift work and patients come and go. And at a place like New Hope Community, this is their home and they can live there from 20 to 90. And you can build incredible relationships with them, your other staff, the families that are involved, our community partners. It's an incredible opportunity.
Do you need to have a medical background, or are there opportunities for folks? You mentioned nursing, but you also mentioned there's training available. So just talk about, like, opportunities for folks who are listening, who want maybe want to get involved, but maybe think they don't have the right qualifications, quote unquote.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, on a DSP level, we're actually rolling out a GED program with SUNY Sullivan, so that if there are people that did not finish high school, they can actually be hired by us as an associate DSP. They can go through a GED program and have someone in-house that mentors them and really allow them to get that in their back pocket and start by us helping them achieve something that should be a plus for the rest of their lives. And we have a very strong training department. We do a lot of mentoring and cohorts. We have tremendous opportunities for growth. And we have training staff that go into the houses and literally say, what do you need in this house so that you can accomplish what you need to accomplish? And they listen to the voices of the people that live there, the staff that work there. And we very much individually create training resources that speak to what they need so they can have the capacity to do their job.
Where can folks get more information about the job opportunities that are available?
Oh my gosh, we would love to hear from people. And of course, nurses are nurses in terms of you need your license, but we'll build you from there. But all you need to do is go into www.newhopecommunity.org. We have a wonderful social media presence, and you can find us on just about everything with Instagram. And we have a little TikTok. We have Facebook. There's a lot of ways that you could connect, and you can go in there and give us a call and we'll connect you to the right person and the conversation can start.
You're worldwide. And like any good nonprofit, you probably have a fundraiser coming up. You have your golf fundraiser. That's a significant source of funding because, as you said, it is your responsibility and the funds are not always available in other places. So what's this fundraiser?
Yeah, this is an exciting, our 15th golf outing, which is happening on May 12th. And it is at the West Hills Golf Course in Middletown. And it's a wonderful opportunity to support us. It's a wonderful full day out on a beautiful course. There's lots of prizes to win. There's good food. There's wonderful fellowship. It's a fantastic outing. So we're really looking forward to a good turnout. And every time people show up and have a blast together, we just feel like it's, again, it's fellowship and it's providing necessary funding to really like push us forward in a very important mission. We also have our 50th gala coming up in November because we are 50 years old.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, and that's in November at the Barn at the Villa in Middletown. That's going to be a really big deal. We've got a lot of special surprises, so people could always ask us about that as well.
Before we go, I just want to ask you, just personally, what's some of the most rewarding parts of the work that you do for the people that you serve?
Oh gosh. You know, I would say first and foremost, it's when you see that what you're doing actually creates a positive change in a person's life that you're supporting. And would they end up being able to take a trip that they never thought they could take, or they could actually partake in, we have a tremendous Special Olympics program. Oh, they're playing darts. Oh, they're playing flag football. Oh, they're doing like all these wonderful things and basketball, and we're cheering them on and, you know, singing We Are the Champions. And it's like, oh my gosh, they're realizing things they never thought they could. And then you expand that out to the staff and the families and to the community. And it's like, look at us. Look what we can do collectively as people who care.
Really showing and identifying the humanity in all of us. Debbie McGinnis is the CEO of New Hope Community. There's more information at newhopecommunity.org. Thank you for being here.
Oh, and thank you so much.
Thank you for all you're doing for our community.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll hear from the Victims Intervention Program about the NEPA Medical Advocacy Conference coming up in April. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is poet, author, and meditator Diego Perez, better known as Young Pueblo. He's known for his advice on personal development and healthy relationships. He'll talk to Forrest Hansen about his new book, How to Love Better. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Wayne Memorial Hospital and Wayne Memorial Community Health Centers have joined together in sponsoring the third annual NEPA Medical Advocacy Conference coming up April 9th at Marywood University. It's a collaboration between WRC and Scranton and Victims Intervention Program, or VIP, in Honesdale. The partnership brings together healthcare providers and community agencies to support victims and survivors of abuse with critical resources and information. Here to tell us more is Erica Thaxton, medical advocate at the Victims Intervention Program. Erica, good morning.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit more about the NEPA Medical Advocacy Conference and the theme, Empowering Voices, and the significance.
Yes. So WRC and VIP work together every year to put on the Medical Advocacy Conference. It's the only conference like it in the northeastern Pennsylvania region. The medical advocate there, her name is Sabrina, and myself, work with a team of different collaborators, different community partners. This year, the theme is about empowering the voices, helping to bridge the gaps between the survivors and survivors' needs, in addition to their healthcare and medical needs. We have people come from all over Pennsylvania. We have people that have come from the state health department as well as the state coalitions. And it's all about bringing everyone together, whether it be healthcare providers, people that work within the communities, social workers and school counselors and educators, bringing everyone together under one roof to learn really, okay, what are we missing? Where can we do better? And what's new? What are some of the trends that we're seeing? How can we improve our screening processes? And really, how can we do more to reach the survivors of these terrifying crimes?
And so really coming together to bridge that victim advocacy and healthcare to improve outcomes for abuse survivors, right?
Yes, definitely. Because the sad truth is that so many of these crimes are often never even reported. You know, all the numbers and stuff that we have available to us, although shocking, if they're so low in the big scheme of things, if we actually had everyone coming forward with their stories, all of those numbers would skyrocket.
What are some other challenges that healthcare providers face in supporting abuse survivors, and how can they be overcome?
So the biggest one is just knowing, right? I mean, you have to put yourself in the position or in the mindset of someone that has lived this life. This is not something that has just occurred one time, right? When you're in an abusive relationship, it's a pattern, and it's a pattern of tactics that are used from one person against another to gain power and control. All forms of abuse are rooted in power and control. So you have been in this situation over and over and over again, whether it be days, weeks, years, sometimes even decades. By that time, you are so well informed as to what to say, what not to say, to still paint that picture of everything is great, everything is fine, I'm fine, you're fine, we're all fine. So just noticing the signs, and on top of that, knowing what to ask and knowing how to ask it. Right. So studies have shown so many times that when we are screening patients for abuse and safety, they're not lying to us. They're answering the question that they are being asked. Right. So when we ask questions like, you know, do you feel safe at home? Yes. That doesn't mean that they're lying to you. They're answering you. Maybe they don't live with their abuser. Maybe their home really is their sanctuary and their safe place, but that's because that other party is not there, right? If we just reframe the way we ask these questions, such as, do you feel safe in your everyday life? Do you feel safe from with the people that are closest with you, right? Still very simple and direct yes or no answers. But they really do broaden the question that we're asking outside of the four walls of the home and to envelop all aspects of your life. Abuse and violence does not just occur between intimate partners, right? You have families, you have teen dating violence. There's so many, you know, elder abuse. There's so many different types of violence that does not all occur within the home.
The medical advocacy conference is coming up April 9th at Marywood University in Dunmore. As I mentioned, April is also Sexual Assault Awareness Month. What are some of the calls to action that VIP is doing during this month?
Yeah, so this is a very busy time for VIP and all programs throughout, you know, throughout the country. You know, little known fact, but every county within Pennsylvania and pretty much throughout the country has to have a dedicated sexual assault and domestic violence program. Sometimes those programs are separate agencies. Sometimes both services are in one shop, so to speak, like ours, and WRC as well is a dual program type of role. But Sexual Assault Awareness Month is a nationally recognized awareness month. So all over the United States, programs and even government offices do special campaigns to really bring the issue of sexual assault to the forefront. It's always a really exciting time for us. It's a great time to get the community involved, get the education out there. And the key to education, of course, is always going to be prevention, right? So learning how can we avoid this, because we have to understand we are never going to be able to stop it, unfortunately. Crime is never going to go away. So here in Wayne and Pike counties, because VIP serves both, we have a lot of different stuff going on. So April 1st is like that first initial call to action. It's also called Teal Tuesday. So we invite everybody and anybody who owns any sort of teal clothing to please wear your teal clothing that day, just to unify, stand up with survivors and, you know, say, hey, we see you, we hear you, and we support you. If you are able to, or if it's a group of people or individually, take a picture, feel free, put it online and tag VIP or tag the program that is within your area. You can, you know, hashtag SAM, S-A-A-M, again, just to help unify the voices all over the place. April 30th is Denim Day. Denim Day was started many years ago, and it came out of a case that occurred over in Italy, where a woman was actually in trouble with her work or whatever because she was a sexual assault victim, and in the end, the court decided that her jeans were too tight. So in order for her to have removed them for her to be assaulted, she would have had to help. Therefore, placing that blame on the victim. And ever since then, there has been a nationally recognized Denim Day throughout all of April and all of Sexual Assault Month. That, again, wear every and any piece of denim, stand up, take pictures, post them online, spread the news, right? This year, we usually do like a Take Back the Night event, and this year is the second year in a row that we've been lucky enough that we are able to plan it and do it on the same day as Denim Day. So here in Wayne and Pike counties, we're also doing a Take Back the Night event. Again, Take Back the Night is run all over the United States, different events and event spaces for that, but it's a time for the public to come out, the community members to come on in. There's different projects. There's different visual things that you'll see. We always have survivor stories where we'll have the survivors themselves speak, or we also invite survivors to write something for an advocate to read if they want it shared but aren't ready to share it themselves. Or if they don't want it shared at all, if they want to draw a picture and have it displayed there, whatever they want to do, we want to lift them up and aid in their healing journey. So this year, our Take Back the Night again is April 30th, and it's going to be held at the Black and Brass, which is inside the Holly Hub on the bottom floor there, right in Holly, Pennsylvania. So it's a good location for both Wayne and Pike County residents to kind of meet in the middle.
And
lastly,
yeah, go ahead.
Throughout all of April, Black and Brass is going to be making and serving a special brew of coffee. I believe it's called Healing Grounds. And that will be available at Black and Press throughout all of April. And keep your eye out, because there's also some local bars or businesses, restaurants that have teamed up with us and that are going to be offering specialty teal-colored drinks or cocktails or different items such as that, again, just to build that awareness about Sexual Assault Month and to support our cause.
And lots of great ways for folks to get involved in supporting your cause. Before we go, I just wanted to ask if someone knows of someone who's being abused, or you suspect abuse, or you're being abused yourself, what can people do? How can they take advantage of the services that you provide?
So that is such a hard thing, right? When someone close to us or someone that we love, we know that they're being hurt, or we get that gut feeling something's not right here. I can tell you the hardest part is starting the conversation, right? Just gearing yourself up mentally and emotionally to have that conversation. Keep in mind, it's always recommended to do this as a one-on-one thing. You don't want, especially if the abusive party is there, you never bring this up. So really, one-on-one, make it a neutral, safe space, such as meet somewhere for lunch, coffee, go for a walk, sit in the park, something, just where both people can feel safe and comfortable and have that guard down a little bit. Just ask the question, right? Ask them flat out, but be prepared to hear the response. As a party or as a person that is asking these things, you are very much entitled to your own feelings and views and attitudes, right? You obviously care about this person. It's only natural to be upset or to be worried and angry. However, we have to remember that in that moment, our own personal items of business, so to speak, are put on the back burner, right? Whatever this person says, we are supporting them. There are 1,000 different reasons why people don't leave a relationship at that exact time. And it's very easy for somebody on the outside to say, hey, I know what you need to do. But in reality, you don't, because you're not living it. If they're telling you no, there's a reason why they're telling you no, and you need to believe them on that, right?
Yeah.
As they feel comfortable, they'll share things with you. But the biggest thing is ask the questions and just be supportive. So whatever they say, go with it.
Yeah, and there's also a hotline at VIP, 570-253-4401 or 570-296-HELP. All calls are confidential. Also, more information at your website, vipempowers.org. Erica,
there's also an online chat service on that website, and the 253-4401 is our text line as well. That's confidential. All services are free. Please reach out, or reach out, you know, if you have questions about somebody else, reach out anytime.
Erica Thaxton, medical advocate for the Victims Intervention Program in Honesdale. Erica, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, what seniors need to know about genetic testing scams. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180. Building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Thane Peterson. Join me for great music from the newest artists, with a little bit of classic jazz from the greats of the past thrown into the mix. Living Jazz, Saturday at noon, only on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Genetics testing company 23andMe filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy this past Friday, and scammers are targeting seniors with genetic testing scams. What should seniors know about their data? I spoke to Maria Alvarez, executive director of the New York Statewide Senior Action Council.
The one thing about 23andMe is that it does, I mean, what we talk about is Medicare fraud, and Medicare would never pay for something like that. You know, so it would, they would not be able to charge that. But what I would say is that if your information is, you know, is in, you should definitely try to get a hold of where your information is, because I assume that people have given a lot of who they are, a lot of background information and things like that. So they, it would be very important for them to know and to secure where that information is.
And potentially delete that information as well, because, you know, right, that could still be compromising for scammers. But when we're talking about scammers and Medicare fraud, how did they use genetic testing scams to rip people off?
Well, what happens is, of course, the what you know, they're always trying new things with these fraudsters. So the latest is that what they will do is try to get to tell the person that they would be screening them for things like their genetics, their DNA, do they have, you know, certain conditions. And cancer, things like that. And the key is that they would say they would tell them, well, this is free to you or no cost to you, just as long as you give me your information. And what they're looking for is the person's Medicare number. And then what they do is they charge Medicare for this information, for this service, which may or may not have even occurred. The issue is that Medicare, unless it's very, very specific and pre-approved, Medicare does not cover genetic testing. It would be a very, very inordinate situation if they actually covered it. So if this fraudster charges Medicare, Medicare does not pay, then what they'll do is they will try to collect from the client, from the patient, and these tests run anywhere between $9,000 and $11,000. So just from the standpoint of not being able to pay something like that, I mean, you should never give out your information to people that you don't know. The other problem is that they, you know, many times this situation might occur over the telephone. And what they'll say is, well, why don't you talk to one of our doctors? Well, you don't know who the doctor is. You know, these things are always best administered by the physician that you know, that knows you. It's probably should be done in an office, right? And by somebody who is going to get your procedure pre-approved to make sure that you're not going to be on the hook for $9,000 to $11,000. But in some cases, let's say at a senior fair or some type of, you know, event in the community, they would try to swab your cheek. They'll say, well, we'll just do this cheek swab and then we'll put it through. Well, that means that then it's somebody, again, who does not have any history, any of your medical history, who is not familiar with you, and they are asking you for your personal information. If somebody came up to you on the street and just asked you for your personal information, you probably would not give it to them, right?
Right.
So this is no different. So we always say that you should guard your card. Don't, you know, treat your Medicare card as if it were your credit card or any other personal document. You don't share it with anybody who you don't know. And don't answer questions, you know, personal questions. If you would like to take information, that's one thing, but do not give out information to people that you really don't know.
And, you know, you mentioned that there could be some legitimate testing that's pre-approved. It's not as common. So how could seniors differentiate between something that's legitimate testing and these fraudulent offers?
I would say that the best thing to do is to speak with your doctor who has your medical history, who you've been seeing for a while, who knows you. If that doctor determines that you need some type of genetic testing, and I'm assuming you're going to have in-depth conversations about this with your physician, Then the other thing that you need to do if you don't want to pay for this yourself, which again is $9,000 to $11,000 for the test, is to make sure that Medicare or your insurance company is actually paying for this, is pre-approving it to ensure that there's no misunderstanding at the end of, you know, at the end of the process.
Some of these scams involve a telemedicine consultation. How does that work, and why is it particularly concerning?
Because so what happens is people will call you, and sometimes, you know, sometimes, I mean, this has gotten so sophisticated that the what appears on the caller ID is not really the person who's calling you, right? So it could be a scam artist calling you with a different name. But then they call you, and then when by speaking to you, because they are experts, they may have some of your information. They may have your name, your address, who your doctor is. They may even have your Medicare number, because unfortunately a lot of this information is, you know, exists on the dark web and in other places. But when they call you and they say, well, why don't you, you know, let's speak to our physician who can talk to you and give you some counseling on this process. Well, again, this person doesn't really know you. And these are not people who are legitimately, you know, in the medical field. All they are trying to do is to get your Medicare number. Medicare costs the taxpayer over $60 billion a year in fraud, errors, and abuse. So these are people who are highly motivated and highly trained to elicit numbers from, you know, information and the Medicare number from you, sometimes without you realizing it, because they're that good. So once they get the information, and they will tell you this is at no cost to you, but please give me your Medicare number. And even if they seem to have it, they're just looking for confirmation. So once you confirm that that is your number and it is attached to all of the information that they have on you that they've already confirmed, then they will start charging Medicare on your account. The issue with all of that is that, God forbid, you need some type of procedure later, legitimately, Medicare may not pay because they feel that they've already, you know, been charged and paid for that process.
Let's remind folks how they can protect themselves from becoming victims of these scams. Are there any proactive steps seniors should take to safeguard Medicare information?
Absolutely. The first thing is, like I said before, guard your card. Treat it as if it's your credit card or one of your most prized documents. Never give out information to people who you don't know. Only trust your doctor that knows you and that has your medical history and your loved ones. Number two would be to always check your Medicare statement notices and the explanation of benefits, because on those documents, that's where all of the everything that Medicare is being charged or your insurance company is being charged on your behalf appears. If you see that there are charges that you don't remember or you don't agree with, then you can always call the doctor, call Medicare, or even call us, because we're the Senior Medicare Patrol, and our counselors are, you know, provide free and unbiased assistance to help resolve these issues.
And that number they can call is 800-333-4374. There's more information also at nyseniors.org. We've been talking to Maria Alvarez, Executive Director of the New York Statewide Senior Action Council. Maria, thanks again as always.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, you may have seen the heads of PBS, NPR, and Alaska Public Media yesterday testifying in Congress, underscoring public media's essential role in meeting the everyday needs of communities across America like ours. Yet some members of the House subcommittee renewed calls to completely defund public media, threatening the very services you depend on every day. One way to make sure we're here to serve our community is to donate now at WJFFradio.org as we approach our spring fund drive and as we head into this uncertain period for the future of public media. We thank you for your support and thank you for listening. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, this is Matt Hurtado. Join me for Virtual Soundscapes, your gateway to the best music in gaming. Classic tracks from the 8-bit era, modern releases, and interviews with the minds behind the games. Thursday night at 10 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Sunny today and a high of 43. Tonight, a low of 30. And tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high near 50. Looking ahead to the weekend, Saturday, a high near 70, partly cloudy skies. Some showers around Sunday and a high of only 50. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.